Welcome to this month's City Talks, where we'll be discussing how immigration relates to UK cities. In one respect, the relationship is clearly a close one. At Centre for Cities, we never tire of reminding people that immigration is an urban issue. 78% of immigrants to the UK locate in cities, and nearly half, 48% of them, in London alone. This preference isn't new or surprising. Economic migration from the countryside to cities drove the Industrial Revolution over 200 years ago. And as long as cities continue to be places of opportunity and social mobility, they will remain magnets for migrants. But there is an interesting twist to this relationship. In recent months, immigration has overtaken the economy and the health service as the most important issue the public is concerned about. However, the places with such worries are most deeply felt tend to be in areas with relatively little immigration. So is immigration a cipher or a scapegoat for those concerns like welfare and economy? And would cities suffer if immigration was reduced? Joining me to discuss these questions, I have Sundar Katwala, Director of British Future, and Phoebe Griffith, Associate Director of Migration, Integration and Communities at IPPR. So Phoebe, turning to you first, there's quite a lot of debate about the impact of immigration on the economy. Where do you stand on the contribution that migrants make, particularly the, I suppose, the more cosmopolitan, globally mobile, creative class that we often hear about?
I mean, the latter group is easy, I think. Most people agree that there is a huge advantage to being open for business to the most creative, upwardly mobile, wealthiest, if you will, migrants. I think even Migration Watch, who is considered to be one of the most sceptical think tanks, would probably buy into that idea. And it's interesting what's happened in the UK in the past years. We're very aware of the fact that there is a global competition for talent. Many countries, not least Germany most recently, are very active in that market for talent and expertise and potential. But in fact, our government has sort of taken some quite sort of big steps to sort of limit it. We've put a cap on the number of migrants we accept into the country. We're not allowing students to stay in the UK after they complete their studies. And whilst, I mean, we're still seeing, increased migration, we still see, London and other cities like Cambridge acting as real hubs of talent and international talent in particular, it is starting, I think, to generate a sort of branding problem. And I think our uniqueness is sort of starting to be kind of, I think, affected by some of the sort of big talk around reducing migration at any cost. Mm-hmm. And countries like Germany are really seizing on that opportunity. They're not being slow about it. So I do think there is a role for cities to sort of rise above that and sort of to actually promote themselves as kind of distinct entities who are open for business, who do want sort of the best PhDs to come and sort of reside there, who do want creative people to sort of set up businesses and to develop, help them develop economically and sort of culturally and in other aspects. Mm.
Sundar, what gives your perspective, opening perspective on the state of the immigration debate and some of the big issues that are being the lightning rods really for a lot of the debate and discussion?
Well, there's a lot of public anxiety about immigration, how it's managed and how it's handled. I think there are a number of different reasons for that. One is that immigration is historically high, higher than it has been, and therefore the scale and pace of change feels high and fast to a lot of people. It's also, there's a sense in Britain particularly, I think, that government hasn't really got a grip on what it's trying to do, and I think that's been true of successive governments. The Labour governments were perceived to say we're not expecting much immigration from Central and Eastern Europe when free movement expands, and we had the largest ever wave of immigration. So there's a sense, because it was unanticipated, it was unplanned for, and perhaps that government was then in denial about how to manage it. This government said it will learn from those mistakes and it will get the numbers down, and a promise to get the numbers down has actually been combined. They fell for a bit. Combined record levels of immigration. If politicians tell you they're going to do one thing and the opposite happens, then your sense of competence in how it's managed actually falls away, and your sense of trust in the competence of managing immigration falls away. So there are big challenges for those in cities or beyond who want to defend the cultural economic benefits of skilled and economically beneficial migration, to secure political consent from the society they're in that can work and that's a good thing.
Both of you, but it strikes me that a lot of the debate and the conversation has been of an economic nature, and lots of debates about, you know, whether economically we see some gains to the overall country or whether there's some distributional issues, particularly at the lower wage end. I suppose get reflections from both of you on the economic arguments. But I suppose a bigger question to start off is, you know, is that the right place to start when we talk about immigration?
I would see that as a slightly phony war, really, because depending on which side you're already on, you can probably find a study or statistic that proves it. There's, you know, the balance of evidence is there are aggregate economic gains of a modest kind, and maybe there are bigger gains over the long term. But immigration isn't just about economics. It's about culture, identity, belonging. Fundamentally, it's about quite an important question: how do people become us? Mm. And therefore, there isn't ever going to be a study or a killer statistic that means, you know, if there's a net contribution and you're worried about it, then you've made a mistake. Because the question of how well we manage it, what we ask of people to contribute, to be a part of the club, and how the club then treats people that are, and what it means to be us in a society of rapid change. These are good questions, and I think some of the failure of the liberal end of the debate has been to engage in a debate primarily about cultural identity and belonging with sort of statistics and graphs saying we think we're right and you're wrong.
Phoebe.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that we do need to engage with the cultural question, but I would dispute that culture is something fixed. You made the point in your introduction that it's interesting how it's areas of high migration where people seem most at ease with it, and it's those areas of low migration where we've seen this sort of real kind of the real concerns sort of come out. I've been doing quite a lot of research in cities like Slough, for example, which has seen, you know, a big trajectory over the last 15 years. It has happened quite quickly, but in effect, whereas 15 years ago people were deeply disturbed by what was happening around them, migration is now actually very normalised. They've seen it as a fact of life. And I think you could sort of see similar patterns in places that, you know, 15 years ago were deemed incredibly challenging, including places like Luton and Barking and Dagenham, where whilst, you know, there is a group, some people refer to them as the left behind, that remains deeply troubled by the changes around them, the mainstream of those areas has actually sort of come to terms with the fact that there will be a Polish shop in the high street, that, you know, alongside their children, there will be children who don't speak English at home, but who are increasingly fluent in English in their classroom, and that doesn't matter. That, you know, potentially they'll start eventually having friendships and other things. So I think places do catch up, and the fact is that, you know, these transitions are going to take place, whatever our migration policy is in the future. You know, we've made projections, we've seen it over the past sort of 5 years. Our immigration policies have become increasingly hard line, particularly if you benchmark against other European countries and beyond. And migration remains at a record high. So I think, you know, we need to sort of think in terms of sort of how do we adapt, how those cultural questions do evolve.
I think we can learn something important from that feature of, you know, high diversity areas having more confidence in diversity, particularly if they've got a longer history of having more diversity. And that's because I think the pressures of change are real. In terms of not dropping the ball on providing school places and making sure the resources flow more quickly behind the populations, which I think hasn't been done well enough. But while those pressures are real, they are trumped by the experience of contact. And if you have contact and it's good and it goes well, and especially if you grow up with that contact in the classroom, then a sort of higher pace of change can feel more normal. Yeah. Across the generations. So that's important, but we shouldn't dismiss then the idea that people who are worried about immigration, who live in areas of less change, have just made a mistake, because they haven't got any, because there are national level concerns here as well. And actually the pattern is that most of us are quite confident about the places we live, but more anxious about the state of the nation. Because does the national immigration system work? Is it effective and fair to people who need protection? Does it lose the files, or does it make a good decision? Do we get integration right at a national level? So people might be confident about the areas they live, but worried about what's happening in the big cities if they don't live there. And therefore having an account of identity, belonging, citizenship, national cohesion at a national level is also important to people who aren't necessarily in the areas of.
I agree with that, but there's an interesting, you know, and we've had numerous failed attempts to try and articulate what some of those cultures or what some of those values are, you know, in a national sense, because they become too abstract and they don't mean anything to anyone.
Too dogmatic.
Dogmatic. Yeah. So I'd be interested in, you know, your thought about how that some of those issues are resolved. Is it only by experience, by participation, that actually we can deal with some of these issues, or how do we deal with them at a principal or a sort of philosophical level?
I've always found sort of political attempts at sort of coming up with the kind of the big narrative on what it means to be British have been counterproductive inevitably, because they tend to exclude more people than they include. Most recently, for example, that sort of big effort to make sure that schools were teaching Britishness, British values. I've been to talk to teachers in schools, and what they do is they bend the rules because they find it's completely irrelevant in the classroom, particularly if they have a classroom of people from who speak 25 languages.
Yeah.
So it becomes a very symbolic kind of approach to dealing with questions of national identity. It might placate people who are deeply concerned about it, but when in practice they sort of don't see it playing out in reality, I think it probably becomes counterproductive.
I feel we lack confidence about this. I think there's an elite anxiety about whether we can do it or not, or what does it mean, and is it an overcomplication of it sometimes, actually, because if you get out there and you ask people, and actually if you ask people across classes, across ethnic groups, across faith groups, is it important that we do this? The answer is yes. And then, do we know what the content is? People do scratch their heads a bit. British identity might be difficult, but actually you start that conversation and there's a lot of latent consensus to unlock, actually, about what it's about. So perversely, people think it's important that we have a shared sense of belonging in a diverse society. We haven't paid enough attention to it. What do they think the cornerstones of that are? Number one, overwhelmingly, respect for the free speech of other people when you don't agree with them, because you want your free speech respected too. You can get a lot of the content of common citizenship out of that. It goes with the rule of law, it goes with contributing, paying your taxes and so on. This might sound a bit motherhood and apple pie to people. People are reassured to have that conversation. You can also, though, which I think hasn't happened, then see and feel that happening at a local level, perhaps in a more show, not tell way. Not in a very American way. I don't think people want to salute flags in classrooms and sing anthems. But there are traditions that matter a lot to us. The tradition of remembrance is a very powerful one that has the potential to provide a lot more common ground locally where you live than you think. That's a really emotionally important thing. And yet people don't know, in their fast-changing city, in Birmingham or in London, actually those armies that fought on the Somme 100 years ago, they look like the London and Birmingham of today, not the London and Birmingham of 1914. And so there's a shared ground that people didn't know they had, a shared history that people didn't know they had. And actually cities generally telling the stories of their history, that has been made up of people, who weren't Mancunians, who became Mancunians, and what that means to the next wave is quite powerful and quite emotional and quite important.
But I think as long as it's an avenue for kind of quite critical appraisal, history of empire will mean something completely different for someone whose parents came from Jamaica and I think, as long as you use that common history as an avenue to explore those complex, often quite difficult questions. But if you take the sort of Michael Gove approach, which is win-win-win, and if you don't believe, if you're not sort of on our side, therefore you're not part of us,
I think that risks being a bit of a caricature of Michael Gove. But leaving that aside, actually, when you do it, you want to say our history's made us who we are. It's complex, a history of empire, decolonisation, post-war immigration, integration, our changed cities and all of that. But actually, people don't then polarise about it. They say we need to know this. And there was a period of time, I think, in the classrooms of our multi-ethnic cities when we thought we'll steer away from that. But you don't want a multi-ethnic classroom to be taught about empire decolonisation because it will divide people. But you've got no other way to explain why the classrooms of East London, Birmingham, West London look like they do.
But you mentioned earlier on, Sander, both of you in fact, Phoebe as well, talked about, there seems to be a concern that it's out of control, in that, the numbers are ever greater and increasing at ever faster rates, that issues around integration and absorption, that others have raised about, it's not so much, it's not only the numbers that we're concerned about, but it is the ability of Britain to absorb those and integrate those individuals into communities, into different places. Just, is that right? I mean, is there a, this is all out of control, that's why I'm against it?
There's a sense of, you know, governments haven't managed it well, right. Partly because what government said would happen hasn't happened, and actually on an area of low political trust, making promises you don't keep really exacerbates that mistrust. There are some people you cannot, you know, acquiesce to, appease on this. If people want the country to look like it looked in 1950, that isn't going to happen. They know that as well. And if all they want to say is, well, I'm looking forward to seeing it all fail and fall apart, then they're not engageable. There are a set of engageable, legitimate anxieties that are not mistaken that people have, which are, does the system work? Do we have a fair deal about what we want you to contribute, you know, whether that's, you know, working and paying taxes, or what it means to contribute in order for you to join a new society? What makes you and your children just as British as the rest of you? And when you want to join our society, do we then treat you fairly and equally, because that's the type of society we'll be? You can get a long way in saying, you know, if the pace of change speeds up, we've got to work harder with those questions. And actually quite a lot of people are anxious about immigration are surprised to be offered a conversation that asks the question not what's changed in the past, but what should we all do now? People are surprised to have a constructive conversation about that. A lot of people, I think, want constructive, practical answers to those questions.
But I think the starting point is migration is going to be here to stay. And I think that's been one of the sort of the big problems. You know, my analysis is that there are big global trends at play over which the British government might have some control, but not huge control. You know, international development, it's a myth that it leads to less migration. There's definitely a point where it actually leads to more population movements. You know, aspirant, educated graduates wanting to sort of actually further their skills will want to come to the UK and do that. I think there's also big developments in technology, in international travel at play. I think one of the interesting things of the refugee crisis is also, you know, in the past, big refugee crises have taken place. You mentioned sort of rural to urban migration, very much at the heart of, you know, one of the consequences of big sort of civil wars, but also south to south migration. But I feel that that's changed now, actually, that, you know, these big displacements of people are probably going to be much more south to north as well, and that, you know, one of the striking images on our TVs of people coming off those boats is the fact that they all have mobile phones.
Yes.
And that they're, you know, they're very interconnected, they're very sort of plugged into social media, so I think there's a lot at play sort of internationally, and let's not ignore the fact that we are aging as a society, you know, and that's a conversation that in Germany was had in 2005, very honestly, when, you know, there was a coming to terms with the fact that this is going to be part of our national story at this point. And, you know, for the last 5 years, we've denied that, and that's what's really eaten into public confidence, I would argue. You know, we've done a lot, you know. The UK is a hard line on immigration now, I would argue. We are the myth that we have open borders is, you know, is insane.
But I think,
and
people,
actually, we've seen no progress.
People do country. Understand, I think, that immigration is part of the modern world, and therefore it is going to be part of the picture, and also it has been part of our society. I think we shouldn't go so far as to say, therefore, we don't have any control on any choices, because actually we have some
big choices,
which are important. For example, we could get out of the European Union, or we can stay within
it. That's what some are advocating.
That's a big question, but it's quite interesting when you have a referendum. You actually put that not with the political class, you put that with the people.
Yes.
And then they've got to decide, is that a very big leap to make? What are the risks of making that? You know, if they don't make that leap, what other choices do they have?
Yeah.
We control the type of non-EU immigration we have. And while we have EU free movement, we actually choose not to have, or don't really have, non-EU unskilled immigration, and we're quite tight on skilled immigration from outside the EU. We can choose.
But
there was public pressure.
Also increased.
Yeah, there was public pressure to take more Syrians.
Yes.
Because we decide as a country what we do to uphold that tradition, and saying we're actually proud that when, you know, Hitler persecuted the Jews, and when Idi Amin throughout the Ugandan Asians, we were proud to stand up. Then, you know, we all know you can't say that you're proud of that and not take any Syrians today.
So coming back, picking up on that issue, and you know, as we've said before, 80%, you know, 4/5 of the immigrant population go to urban areas. About half are in London, and when you look at the polling about acceptability of immigration, that seems to be much higher in in cities than it is, you know, at the national level or in other places. So you can almost think about cities as being a great, I don't know, an integrated machine, really, or mechanism by which people are absorbed into the society and then others feel comfortable. Why is that? What's going on there?
I think there's sort of some kind of quite technical things, you know, diaspora effects, for example, yeah. You know, which play a major role in the decisions of migrants.
And when you say diaspora effects, what do you mean by that?
Well, basically, you know, your cousin lives in London, you go and sort of sleep on their couch, you find a job through word of mouth, and then you tell your friends back home to come and join you, and that's sort of often the most powerful kind of sort of trigger for people to decide to migrate. I think also, for obvious reasons, it's easier to melt in a city like London. Mm. And, you know, when I speak to migrants, that's something that they treasure, right? The fact that no one actually, they're unidentifiable, right? And it's starting to happen in cities like Slough. And I know the sort of scale in London is disproportionate, but nevertheless, you can go to Coventry and just live in Coventry now and no one really bats an eyelid. Yeah. So yes, I think there are other factors at play, but one of the important trends, and this is sort of what sort of cities that might be newer to this need to take stock of, is the fact that this is dispersing very rapidly. You know, cities like Boston, which have seen sort of 125% increase in their sort of net migration over the course of, you know, less than a decade. Mm. You know, very, very quickly, cities like Coventry, big university cities, seeing much larger scale migration. I think, you know, cities like Manchester and Liverpool will become much more emboldened about sort of where they sit in what we were talking about at the beginning, which is the sort of global competition.
Because migration becomes more suburban, it goes to smaller towns and experiences for the first times. There are learnings there from cities, because what cities did, and as it speeds up, cities can't now say, well, we know we've done it before, so it will surely happen again. I think we can do some work on it. What cities did historically, if you think about the great cities, you know, across Europe, whether it's Barcelona or Manchester or Turin, you know, great inflows of people into industrial places, and there were identity gaps to be filled, and they were filled with
so
a story
that a deliberate
of the city.
Act,
I think
it was organic.
It was organic, right. But it was deliberate too, at the level of, you know, if you have powerful local actors in government, in business, but you get the great football clubs of Europe from filling the identity gaps that exist in cities, and therefore you know now that you can become a Londoner or a Mancunian or a person of Barcelona, and you can share a sense of civic attachment to things that belong to the city. But interestingly, these are not, which often happens, these are not stories about migration that are they are good for us stories. They genuinely are the new us being created together stories. So I think cities can do that again. But the challenge now is to spread the confidence of the city beyond the city limits.
Yeah.
We know it can work in places of quite high churn, if you have contact, if you have things we do together, and if people do meet over time. How does that play out in the broader polity of which you're part? And your political consent to be a city really depends, you know, on the political context beyond the city environment.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that'd be interesting. I mean, cities at their heart are the absence of space between activity and between people. In a sense, we collide, not literally, but, you know, sort of culturally, socially, economically with others on a daily basis. And I think there's something going on through that collision which breeds and encourages adaptation and acceptance engagement.
I think it's sort of thinking about the migration question in the context of bigger debates, for example, our big debate on public space, the future of the high street, you know. And I think there's sort of a moment of reflection when you think, you know, if this context is so important as Sundar is arguing, which I believe it is, you know, are there other things that are undermining opportunities for contact? And often we sort of just kind of lay the blame on migrants because they like to form enclaves, they sort of hunker down, they separate, but it might happen. It sort of gradually changes, but what we don't sort of say is actually, you know, what is the impact of shutting down the library, right? How is that going to actually reduce scope for people to just come into contact in a very, very casual, everyday way? We don't really ask that question. It's not part of our, you know, we ask lots of questions about what is the impact of shutting down the library. Not that one yet, but I think we need to increasingly.
I think we could think about the spaces of contact. You know, people think about cohesion as a kind of separate thing. They're going to get people together to discuss difference and cohesion. You just need people to do things together. So thinking about what happens at the school gate, and the way in which the primary school, the secondary school
yeah.
can do that. Because, you know, especially I think in Britain, you know, people would like to do something together, but are not quite sure whether,
shy,
to make,
yeah.
whether to make the first move. And yeah. so do yeah, want yeah. something facilitated. Actually, the use of national days, for example, or, you know, local moments to bring people together, invite everybody to the party, the great willingness to do that. We've seen some of that around the Jubilee. You could see that, I think, happen much more around St. George's Day and so on. It's as important to do this in urban environments and in cities as it is in areas that's
critically, I think people can live on many levels, and I think we get very bogged down on sort of those key relationships like families and friendships, but actually you can do both. You can sort of have those national days where you interact, but it can be quite a spontaneous thing that you do once a year. It will still be quite a powerful experience, and then you can sort of also spend your time, you know, with friends who might not, you know, might share your culture. And that, I mean, I think, you know, to start trying to kind of enforce that sort of interaction, you know, one of the lessons from places like Bradford is that, you know, when you start socially engineering that stuff, it doesn't often work. And, you know, I'd argue you need to be much more behind the scenes, nudging it, being sort of smart about it rather than sort of, you know, making it very explicit that you expect people to interact and be friends, kind of thing.
And where, how do we engender those sorts of opportunities? Who's doing the encouraging, the facilitating, the offering of opportunities, the encouragement of exchange, and those? Where is that coming from? Where,
I think,
you know,
I think,
your experience?
In my experience, there's an unmet appetite for it, and
right.
so we should think about who does that. You know, sometimes we might say, you know, employers should have more responsibility around, I don't know, you know, language learning skills and so on, if they're the people that have brought, you know, a new population or transient population into an area. Other points, I think, you know, I'd say the school gate is a really, really important place where people
are
want
also
this
a sort of
to happen.
Because, I mean, the universities have a huge vested interest in migration, right? You know, this is basically their business plan for the foreseeable future. And, you know, they're using the big, big hefty fees paid by international students to, you know, plug money into their campuses. One of the concerns I have, and I work with universities quite regularly, is, you know, a lot of that is kind of being invested quite in sort of quite circular internal way, you know, to provide more for international students. Particularly in urban universities, I think there's sort of huge scope for
and
them
I could,
to be
I think we could
a
cut a deal there. There's a big political debate
that,
about, I mean, it's one of the areas where the public have quite nuanced views. The public think, let's have the students in paying the fees. It's good for the towns and cities we're in. They're on the side of the universities here.
Yeah.
We could ask for something back, I think, which is that, you know, we don't think we should cap that in immigration because it's a good export industry, but those gleaming laboratories
and language
labs, you know, could be put to the use of local populations, you know, in a useful way, actually, as an arena of contact, of, you know, the importance people place rightly, I think, on language learning as the passport to economic, social, civic integration. You know, let's see the universities do that part, you know, it's a sort of soft kind of quid pro quo for getting what you want on immigration policy. Let's put some skin on the game in integration as well.
So would you see those sorts of, I suppose, requirements being more explicitly made under that? New immigrants into the country, there is an expectation that to learn the language and to participate and to be involved. You know, that's part of the offer in terms of being
and
able
that's
to...
That's what most migrants have always thought. If you survey migrants because of selection effects, you know, migrants are just that bit more optimistic about the societies they've joined, you know, when they take up citizenship, they're a bit more patriotic. This, though, is surprising.
But national politicians have always been a bit queasy about you said earlier on, this kind of reluctance of the liberal elite to, you know, to make
we know there's a deal, but it's a, you know, integration here is a two-sided coin. It has the host community in it as well. And the deal is we expect some things, learn the language, be a good citizen, pay your taxes and all the rest of it. And the deal is you become part of the club, and it's a one-tier club. You know, you're just as British as everyone else, and your kids are us. That's the deal that people can have confidence in. We struggle a bit in a way because I think our cities and our countries are quite used to sort of come with your suitcase and stay for life immigration.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's more transient now. And the transient, you know, come and go for a couple of years is more transactional. And then, you know, we might need some rules for transactional migration. We actually prefer people to sort of stay settled and become us. Than to go away again, even if it gets the numbers down.
Yeah. Should we see? I mean, interesting. Obviously, we think about these things from a city's perspective. I'd be interested in your thoughts about you know, the relative importance and maybe how important they should be in terms of the national debate, that cities themselves and their leaders, you know, should be more advocates for, champions of.
And it's happening elsewhere. I mean, the US has something called the Welcome Cities Initiative, oddly spearheaded by Dayton, which is a city that now calls itself the Ellis Island of Ohio.
Right.
And, you know, they've really been quite proactive about lobbying government. They've become quite roguish in many of their policies, you know, for example, telling the police not to kind of check for immigrant status. And, you know, I say this with a sort of a degree of caution because, you know, cities do have an interest in migration being kind of managed and it being selective, you know. So I don't think this is about sort of cities becoming open borders advocates. This is about cities sort of saying, you know, we have an interest in this. We want to have a say in the way that you design immigration policy. We don't want international students to leave the moment they finish their degree because we get nothing out of that other than, you know, the hefty fees that basically go to the university, not to us.
Yeah.
Much better to encourage them to stay in the UK, lay down roots, set up businesses, become, you know, Coventarians or whatever, you know, rather than just see them come and go and drive that transit.
I think there's a very distinct challenge, but also opportunity here for London and for the next mayor of London and for the mayoral candidates. I think there's a danger that people who want to be elected by London with its confidence, its cosmopolitanism and a third of London's foreign born and all the rest of it, you know, it's good that they'll tell celebratory stories about what makes London, London. They've got to be careful, I think, not to talk to and about London, you know, in a way that annoys the rest of the country and actually reduces the sort of permission for London to be London,
right.
Because, you know, there is going to be a European referendum, there is going to be a debate about immigration. So it's important, but actually talking about the gains and pressures for London, of getting housing right at a time of change, of, you know, the feelings of identity and belonging that people have about their very local area, you know, the fact that zone 5 and 6 is, you know, got mixed views about this, that's the challenge, you know, not to talk about it in a way that the rest of the country just hear London sort of off on its own place and they're all thinking, well, we always knew it worked for you, why don't we spread the benefits? But there's an opportunity for London as well, I think, to step up and actually say what makes it work in a city is getting this deal right, of managing the tangible pressures and, you know, dealing with issues of identity. And I think the next mayor could talk about, you know, if London's got, you know, practically half the immigrants in the country, it should be a beacon of something that you'd like to see. As you get more powerful leaders in Manchester and in South Yorkshire and so on, you'd like to see it done there too. And that happening is good for outcomes for migrants and their children. It's good for a sense of fairness and opportunity across society, but it's good for the confidence of the rest of the society too if we're seen to sort of put more elbow grease into the job of making it work and not just doing the celebratory story.
Yeah. Do you think having a national migration system, whether it's particularly, I suppose, at the highest skilled end, which you've touched on, Phoebe, several times, and we know that higher skilled individuals tend to be in cities. Immigrants coming in with higher skills tend to go to universities in those cities, but then if they're forced to leave, you know, there's a worry that, you know, there's an urban effect which will be magnified in London and Manchester and Cambridge and elsewhere. And I wonder whether you think, you know, that we have a national system that in many respects is not fit for places themselves.
I think that's a good description because I think our system is now dictated by a crude single target, which does not differentiate between different sort of, you know, strands of migrants. You know, the Migration Advisory Committee does sort of give advice on what sorts of visas we need to issue, but it isn't fit for purpose. And I think, you know, the needs of different parts of the UK are very, very various. So, you know, we talked about Boston, you know, there's a huge demand for seasonal work, which they have been able to cater for through, you know, migration from Europe. But in other parts of the UK, you mentioned Hull, there's a huge demand for care workers for obvious reasons. Hull is an ageing city. And, you know, in other areas, not just London, but Corby, for example, there's huge demand for construction workers.
Yes.
We could not have had the Olympic Games in the UK without migration. You know, the construction industry would grind to a standstill. And then we have, you know, all the demands for health professionals, which will also be very varied according to the age profile of different parts of the UK, right? So we'll need different specialisms, different types of, you know, different types of doctors at different sort of ends of the health system. So yes, I think there is a huge scope for cities to really appraise their needs. You know, where do we have the labor shortages? Where do we want to develop economically? What's going to be our plan for the future? And to not just think in terms of how we're going to do this, you know, through investment, but also think about it, well, what is the migration factor within this plan? And sort of try to kind of develop their own strategies. That would put them in a really strong footing when talking to national government.
Yeah. It'll be very difficult, though, for cities to cut out a special deal. I think they've got a responsibility.
Some have tried to do that. I mean, Boris Johnson's tried to do it. Manchester and some of the other big cities have said, you know, we need a special preferential or different treatment in the national system.
Yeah, it's difficult to get a public confidence that that's going to work. Yeah. People are going to move once you put them somewhere. But what cities have to do is, I think, be a strong public voice in the national debate so that people are more aware of the balance of trade-offs. We'll get immigration politics and policy right when the public own the trade-offs that politicians actually own. There's a danger in doing it on the basis of the city has special needs. So London could be a powerful advocate that, you know, the tech sector is very worried about skills and people think creating those jobs are good and it's got some universities, but, you know, the universities are everywhere. But, you know, the government has made concessions on health and the NHS. Because hospitals everywhere and find it hardest actually in more rural areas to find the staff they need. Yeah. So making it a special sort of urban claim is difficult. I think cities can say, look, we've got the wherewithal to take more people, make it work, and we can move away perhaps from numbers to, you know, managing it and to integration. But they're going to have to be part of this, you know, of the national debate and of the trade-offs. They can just show that there's, you know, there are gains and pressures here and that people see both sides.
Just on the point that people move, which is, you know, I think based on sort of what happened in Canada. You know, Canada has had a sort of very city-led kind of immigration system, and, you know, everyone points to the case of Alberta, where I think 98% of the migrants who came to went to Canada via that system actually moved out of Alberta within 5 years or something like that. And there's been an evaluation that's shown this. But it's one thing to say that, you know, Alberta, I imagine, is quite a remote place. And you know, if you were able to build a case for a city like Manchester, which has a huge amount going for it, you know, on the basis of a thought through, you know, plan about, you know, our skills base as a as a city, where a migrant will arrive and find plentiful opportunities, you know, a thriving cultural sector and a university, you know, a good standard of living, and won't be spooked by the horrendous, you know, rent prices of London. I think, you know, they have a compelling case to make for why people are likely to sort of stick around and sort of, you know, make a future in Manchester.
You would need public confidence in the, you know, in the controls and the competence. You know, if you design it as a pilot, I think it's most relevant actually to Scotland, because I think Scotland has distinct demographic needs. Yes, you know, Scotland's got the same population that it had in the mid-70s and has held it up when they feared it would drop, but therefore will want to, you know, get more migration and keep the consent for Scotland being welcoming. Actually, in England, where the population's, you know, 10 million higher than it was, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, actually, it's not a demographic challenge of attracting the migrants. It's getting the public consent
now. In some cities, like Newcastle,
to manage it. I think you do want to spread the economy further away, spread the gains and the pressures, because the South East feels population pressures, and other cities would like more growth, more activity, and more migration. So I think the big deal there is spatial and is in distributing it, therefore letting the, you know, letting the sort of the southern powerhouse of London have a special deal actually doesn't deal with what that long-term deal is. Actually, you know, more growth in the north, more population in the north, you know, a bit less pressure on the southeast outside London in population terms, and London probably, you know, being able to absorb people more than anybody else. I think you've got to think in a joined up way about those deals, and actually coalitions of cities can probably do that more than an individual city.
Very good. So as we begin to come to a close, I get two sets of thoughts from you. One, I think initially we get some thoughts about how the debate around immigration needs to evolve and change, and it would be interesting to get your thoughts about how it's already changed, but actually where you see that going over the next few years. And then I suppose the second area to think about is, you know, are there particular policies or particular changes that we would want to see happen to encourage and change that debate, but will need to happen anyway. Sunder, debate first. How do you see the debate evolving over the next 5 and 10 years around immigration?
Let me be counterintuitively optimistic for a moment. In some ways, that the debate's improved in the last few years, people are always worrying about the type of debate we have. One thing that the public think now that they didn't think 3 to 5 years ago, they used to say, we don't think we're allowed to talk about it. And you can say, we've always been debating it. Where's this idea? We're not allowed. They don't say that anymore. They know that it's talked about. So that's become more ludicrous. Hopefully we can now move to, and what should we do now? And, you know, what are the things we can do? You know, I think governments should be looking for promises they can keep rather than, you know, promises that don't work. So can the public now own the trade-offs that, you know, they've got all the dilemmas that people in Whitehall have got because, you know, they feel the pace of change is quite fast, but they definitely want the students, they want the care workers, they want the health workers, they want the job creators, they want integration to work. Actually, if you want integration to work, you've got to welcome people coming and having status and so on. So there's an opportunity there with the debate. There have been some particular features of the last 10 years. The scale of economic immigration from Poland was larger than ever before. That coincided with a set of concerns about cultural identity, integration and Islam because of 9/11, 7/7 and so on. So some quite distinct sort of one-off things, and hopefully we can get those issues right. And at the same time, a demographic issue as well, which is the people who are 65 now, the most powerful voting bloc in our society. They were born in 1950, and so they've seen it change in their lifetime in a very profound way. And actually, as Phoebe has said, you know, playing through that sense of being able to adapt to change is quite important. So I think if we lean into, you know, what do we do to make it work, we could unlock actually a more positive future, not just in the big cities, but actually as the suburbs and small towns become more diverse as well, I think this becomes a hopefully a more normal political issue. And we'll judge governments on the competence of whether they do well what they're trying to do, rather than seeing it as an existential threat to who we are as a nation.
And do you think there are specific policies or sort of decisions that government can or cannot do in order to get us towards that optimistic?
There's one tangible change I think you would make, which is that as the pace of change has sped up to more places, the resources have been too slow to follow people, and people being able to see that happening. So if Grimsby and Lincolnshire are getting more migrants, they're also getting more school places and more hospitals in a way that's linked actually to the tax contributions. That would help. I think that combined with some local and national work about shared identity and integration, not in a forced way. I think Phoebe is right. You nudge it, you don't enforce it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll always worry about the next wave of migrants, I think, as a country. You know, as the Romanians are arriving, we'll say to the Poles, well, you've been here for a while now. So I think, well, but we've got some good anti-prejudice norms in this country to keep the debate within the boundaries of wanting people to integrate on equal terms and wanting to welcome those that do. So I think we can extend that. But, you know, some people will always like change and some people will always worry about it. And, you know, not having too polarised a debate about that, but instead saying, what do we do together to make it work, I think has some constructive, pragmatic potential.
Phoebe, nature of the debate, and then I suppose any specific policies or areas that can push us along.
I mean, yeah, I think we should have seen change 6 months ago. And there was a big missed opportunity. I mean, I think, most people in the sector obviously agree, but I think a lot of people in politics agree that the net migration target should have, you know, gone into the waste paper bin a long time ago, and there was an opportunity was missed.
So at this point, the politics of doing around that,
well, yeah, they've made it that way. So yeah, it's, and you know, the net migration target has
but
some
hurting.
Advantages.
Politically,
at least
hurting.
It's transparent.
This target isn't
working. I mean,
well,
basically,
either.
Exactly. I think that the political calculation has sort of went completely wrong.
Yes.
And I think one of the things that they didn't do is forecast and really think quite. You know, there was a sort of real sense that if you pull the big Westminster lever, this migration would dry up, even if we didn't leave the EU. And you know, that calculation looked very wrong. I think what I'd like to see is a lot more long-term sort of strategic thinking about what's happening elsewhere, not just in Poland. I think Poland is changing dramatically, and I think we'll sort of see much more circular migration, and already it's sort of starting to take place. But, you know, what's going to happen when Turkey potentially exceeds the EU? You know, has anyone in government actually asked themselves that question? And I sort of think, you know, that's been a big sort of gap in our thinking. We haven't really thought about those big trends, and B, the big trends in our labour market which are going to drive migration. And it's not just about health and ageing. I think there's a whole set of other trends. You know, for example, women in the labour market. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something that we've seen growing. You know, the number of breadwinners, female breadwinners is growing. The changing within households is not keeping a pace. So obviously there's going to be more demand on childcare. You know, how are we going to meet that demand? And, you know, again, you know, factoring migration into a much bigger conversation about, you know, our labour market and what it's going to be, what it's going to look like in 10, 25 years' time, and thinking about, well, if we're not going to have migration, what kind of training do we have to be putting in place? How are we going to financing and doing all that calculation? Because, you know, one of the lessons of the last sort of, you know, 5 months, you know, we've heard the nurses union sort of saying, you know, you can't cut migration and cut training budgets. You know, that equation is sort of just poor, short-sighted policy. So you need to have some kind of much bigger, comprehensive assessment.
And are you optimistic, as Sundar, in the sense of the debate and the way that we engage in the debate and the nature of the debate is one that will be better, I suppose, in the future, with more nuance in it, more understanding, more appreciation? Or do you worry that we will, there's a retrenchment back into...
I mean, I look at it on a sort of very personal level, and I mentioned the work we've been doing in SLAB, but it doesn't take a lot for people to change their views somehow. And it's, you know, and it can go both ways, that's the other big point, you know. If you have a bad experience, if you don't get that kid into school and you see someone who doesn't look like you, get that kid, their kid into school, that causes us a lifetime of resentment, I think. But... yeah, I think if you were to plan better, sorry to be really boring about this, probably that situation wouldn't emerge, right?
I think there's a bedrock moderation in British public attitudes. Actually, people think governments have done a really bad job of predicting, managing integration. They actually blame governments. They don't blame migrants. They like the migrants at the school date. They still think governments could, you know, get more of a grip. I think, well, the public want to own those trade-offs and understand actually that they've got views on both sides of the debate, and therefore it's not all the politicians' fault. That's a hard thing for politicians to get across, but I think people don't like polarised culture wars in Britain, actually. They actually want to find a way to pragmatically make it work because it's here. And cities, I think, can be a beacon of that.
Brilliant. And on that great note, my guests today have been Sundar Kadwalla and Phoebe Griffiths. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by the Centre for Cities. We're an independent, non-partisan think tank dedicated to understanding and improving city economies. For more on our research and events programme, including our extensive back catalogue, please visit our website, centreforcities.org.